Welcome to the BristolCon Fringe, a series of readings from the science fiction and fantasy community. This podcast was recorded in front of a live audience in the centre of Bristol.
The part of the evening when we get to put our authors to the question. I guess I'll start with Gareth, as he went first. That was a great story, Gareth. I'm sure I've read that somewhere before. Where was it published?
I can't remember. Some awesome anthology somewhere.
Yeah, I think so.
Do you know if it's for sale anywhere?
It might be, because I think the publishers just did a reprint of it. And being completely full of fail at the moment, she managed to forget to bring copies with her. it's from Dark Spires, which the late great Colin Harvey edited for me. So copies will be available. Of course, it's going to be in a collection named after itself in Pop Angel, coming out from Newcom Press fairly soon. What else are we going to see in that collection?
Well, there's I think there's 20 stories in it, taken from the last 12 years. So there's some that have appeared in small anthologies or magazines, which don't exist anymore or have disappeared. There's a couple that were the sort of best loved ones from my first collection in 2008. And there's about four that have never been published, including one specially written for this collection. So lots of stuff the majority of people won't have read already, I hope.
When are we expecting that?
That's April. It's being launched at EasterCon in Birmingham, but will be available Amazon and all good booksellers. There'll be a limited edition hardback and an unlimited edition paperback.
Brilliant. Okay. Now, the last time you were here reading, we got a preview from a new space opera series that you were writing, which I gather is going to be coming soon. So can you tell us a little bit about that one?
Soon compared with the heat death of the universe.
Ah. Oh dear, like that, is it?
Well, the publication date for the first one is a year, so it's February 2018. What year is it now? Yeah, 2018. Yeah. And then there'll be another one 2019 and another one 2020. At the moment, I'm about 60,000 words through, so two-thirds of the way through the second one.
Right. So provided that Donald Trump doesn't get us into a nuclear war between now and then, we will see it eventually.
If he does, I'm going to be really annoyed. I've put a lot of work into these, and people need to read them.
I'm looking forward to it myself. Let's just swap to Pete briefly. So that was your debut novel, Pete. What's the book called?
City Syndrome. I'm so pissed off I chose that title. You have to have your teeth put to be able to pronounce it.
Pick and pity pit that.
Yes.
Alrighty. And there are copies available for sale at the back?
There are, yes.
How much are they?
Good question. Make me an offer.
Is beer fungible?
Yeah. Beer is always fungible. Yeah.
£8 tonight. Okay, £8 tonight for people later on should they want it. It's a kind of bizarre thing that you had in the story there, where she's apparently in this cottage and it's all entirely fake. It sounds almost sort of prisoner-esque.
Yeah. More Twilight Zone-ish, actually. There are certain bits of the book that are inspired by certain TV programmes, but The Prisoner doesn't really edge in there, unless it's subconsciously, of course.
Okay, yeah. And you said you were trying to find the most science fictional part of it to fit in with Gareth. So what do you think the book is, actually?
Well, it's been marketed as a psychological horror, but I'm not convinced. It's more urban fantasy than anything else.
Right. So it's got like girls in black leather and werewolves?
No werewolves as such, but the
this is a complete note because it's like
There is a girl in black leather, actually. Yeah, so no werewolves as such, but there are ghosts.
Okay, good. All right. So, yeah, that counts as urban fantasy then, I guess. Coming back to Gareth briefly, there's quite a lot of world building that you put in that short story. Have you thought of expanding on that at all, or setting other stories in the same world?
I hadn't. If you look at Jonathan, he's smiling like a Cheshire cat because he's just been bending my ear about doing just that. So
I might have overheard him, of course. Yes.
I don't know, it's a thought, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Now we're all living under the shadow of the bowl.
Yeah. I guess the other obvious question is the vicar based on Paul Cornell's wife?
No comment.
Sorry, Caroline. Do we not have any questions from people in the audience, having stolen one from the mic? If my glamorous assistant, Mr. Parker, here, will move the microphone.
Hello. The process moving, it's actually breaking, moving from short stories to the first novel, what was that like? Was it a sort of leap into the dark, or something you've been working up to for some time via the medium of short stories?
So 6:30 Syndrome started out as two short stories, in fact. So I wrote a short story about something called the Number One Residence Club, which is sort of loosely based on the Napoleon on Notting Hill by G.K. Chesterton. And one of the sort of basis of that has crept into the book. And I did another short story where ghosts were real. And those two short stories kind of played off each other. And then when my publisher said, I'll publish your short story collection if you give me a novel as well. And the only novel that I had completed at that stage I'd already sold to another publisher. So I agreed, and then had to write the novel in a very short space of time indeed, because I signed the contract around about this time last year, and the novel came out in October last year. So I needed something, and those two short stories had sort of, I thought that I could do something with them, and I did. And actually within the book, there was a book within the book, which was a long short story, about a 12,000 word part, which the editor then said, this is great, but it slows everything down. So we put that at the end as a bonus short story. So yes, I think the novel's very short story orientated. The first novel I wrote wasn't at all. It was conceived as a novel, written as a novel. So, I don't know, it was very different.
I sort of came at novels and bounced off. So when I was at college, I had a couple of, two or three, I can't remember now, very short stories published in some Welsh literary magazines. And then I kind of went into the wilderness for a while. When I decided I was going to turn 30, when I decided I was going to admit to turning 30. Yeah, it also coincided with the millennium, so it seemed like time to put my money where my mouth was. So I sat down and wrote a long novel called Silver Sands, which was 100,000 words, and then I spent 2 years editing it down to 49,000 words. I don't know why, I just got rid of all the guff in it, as much as I could get rid of. And then I put it in a drawer for 10 years and started writing short stories. And then once those stories started getting published, I started getting published in Interzone. And then I was approached by Elastic Press to do the first short story collection in 2008. And that led to that novel being unearthed from my sock drawer and published by Pendragon in 2010, Silver Sands, which I've recently republished on Amazon in Kindle and paperback if anyone would like to go and buy it. It's it's like it's a postcard of what I was in my early 30s, I think. It's and it shows its influences a lot. It's somebody who grew up reading a lot of Niven and Clark and stuff like that. So, but having gone back to it and kind of done a pass through it again before republishing it for Amazon, it's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. There's a lot of stuff in there that I can see has continued through my other books, especially the Recollection and the Monkey books, sort of themes and various preoccupations and tropes and things that have continued. So it's kind of like the Rosetta Stone or something. It's where I start, where it started, and you can kind of read it and see where the other books came from a bit, I think. But funny enough, since I've started writing novels properly, short stories have dried up pretty much, because every idea I have now is about 90,000 words long.
So, yeah, I said to you at the bar that it had resonances of the ghost and the machine, the concept of machines attracting entities, dimensions, feeding off them. But I wonder where you got the idea that they could be killed by, in a way, their own coagulated blood.
It was their own feces.
Yeah. Oh, it was their feces. Okay. So it was poisonous too.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I guess I wanted something to kill them, and I was thinking as I was looking. I think I was sitting in Bristol Central Library, actually, looking out at the amount of pigeon shit on the outside of the windowsill. Yeah, and I just thought of this thing squatting there like a bird, and you see bats and things, and there's always streaks of guano down the side. And I thought, well, if this thing's just squatting up there for days, it's going to be extruding something. So if it's absorbing energy, there has to be an output. So that's kind of where that just kind of evolved as I was writing it, really. It wasn't what I was going for, really, was... I think the two words I had in my notebook when I sat down to write it were Somerset Spaghetti Western. So,
that's three words.
Not the way I spell.
And you even had the audacity to start a story with the weather.
Yes.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, the weather is very important, because the weather is life or death to the community, because it's the reason why all the action of the story matters, is because if they don't get the electricity back, they're going to freeze. So
this question about current events. In the last sort of year or so, there's been a resurgence of interest in certain writers who we might call science fiction, Philip K. Dick, Mark Blackwood, these kind of people. I read recently that science fiction is now a better way of understanding the world we live in, the world we might soon be living in, than what you might call realist fiction. As you're both working in this field, are you aware of this, and is this something that you think about, or do you just kind of consider that you're working within the sort of genre of science fiction, that's what you've always done, and you're kind of not so interested in a kind of the popularity of the genre, let's say, based on current events?
Yes. No. Yes. I try not to write extremely near future science fiction based on current events, because by the time it comes out, it's going to be incredibly dated. I see Charlie Stross tearing his hair out, trying to stay one step ahead of current events in his books, and it seems to me a bit of a hamster in a wheel situation, because you're constantly chasing after the news, and every time I turn the news on, you look at it and just go, "What the hell?" And if I'd sat down and written 6 months ago that some senile fascist corporate government, headed up by drunkards and syphilitic, whatever they are, people would have read that and gone, "Come on, tone it down. That's just that's outrageous satire. That's never going to happen." You know, it's like Brass Eye, for God's sake. I saw an episode of that the other day, or the Day Today.
The Day Today, yeah.
The Day Today, it's like a fucking documentary now. What's the episode the Queen punches John Major, and I thought,
could happen.
Yeah, it could happen. It wouldn't surprise me now. So, I think a lot of people writing science fiction ask about predicting the future, and I always say it's not about predicting the future. It's about predicting a future, and there's a big difference, because I'm never going to get it right. Charlie Stross is never going to get it 100% right, even though I'm sure he would beg to differ. It's all you can do is take what you've got around you and use it to comment on the world around you by extrapolating into the future. And it's I've lost my train of thought, but you were talking about Philip K. Dick, and I find it quite ironic that he's so popular now, because at the time he was writing, he was considered brilliant but completely out there, and now it's as if Philip K. Dick died, but he didn't. We all died, and he's still alive somewhere, and we're living in one of his stories. It's
that actually would work in one of his stories.
Yeah.
Well, that's all this year and last year.
There's a book called Losing the Head of Philip K. Dick. One of the first AI experiments was they programmed a machine with all of Philip K. Dick's work, writings, letters, emails, the lot, and it had a head based on him. And in a sort of Dickian plot, they lost it on a plane. So we're out there, there's an AI machine based on Philip K. Dick. To get back to your question then, I don't often write what I term science fiction. It depends where you want to split hairs on with regards to genre. So there's some people would like to say that the SF stands for speculative fiction rather than science fiction. But anything that you write is a commentary on today, really, I think. Although, as Gareth said, you know, by the time you've written it and sold it, it's probably out of date. I'm just trying to sell a short story around about September last year, which was about the situation of a number of museums and libraries being defunded and closed down. And that seems terribly quaint now. You know, there are bigger issues in the world, but at the time I was very angry about it, and now it doesn't seem to be that big an issue, although it fits in the whole zeitgeist of anti-intellectualism.
Can I just sort of ask a follow-up question to that? Because you say,
sure. Thanks.
You say that the kind of the issue of libraries seems sort of, you know, rather kind of quaint or whatever. But do you now feel, when you look around you at the world, which seems to be sort of accelerating in quite peculiar and bizarre directions on a day-to-day basis, do you feel that your imagination is struggling to keep up with that? Do you kind of feel like the state of the world that we're living in is somehow challenging our ability as writers to kind of to conceive alternative realities?
There is. I mean, when Trump was elected, on the day he was elected, I was at a poetry reading, an anti-Trump poetry reading, which I'd written several anti-Trump poems, and it just didn't seem real. And for a while after that, it was kind of, well, how do you go on? The world's just really going to go to hell in a handcart, because, you know, the anti-intellectuals are the one. And that was astounding, but I mean, there's been a number of inspiring writers, including one that's sat not too far away from me, written of how to carry on writing in a world that's going to shit. So I'll hand over to him.
Thank you. Didn't realise anyone read my blog. Part of the reason my next book is set 500 years in the future is because you need that distance, you need to draw a breath and say,
I don't want reality to catch up with me before I've written the third chapter. So, but it's very much talking about today, even though it's at that remove. And I think there was a quote which I've been struggling for the last 5 minutes to remember, I read the other day, that I thought was fantastic about science fiction being an assault on reality from the future, which I liked. But I think what Pete was alluding to just now about keeping writing in a crisis, I found it very difficult, especially during Brexit and then the Trump victory. I went through a very like, what do these sci-fi stories matter? Why am I spending my life writing this when the world's going down the toilet? Shouldn't I be out, you know, stockpiling tin cans and cricket bats? And then I kind of realised that there were people writing stories in 1939 in Berlin. There were people writing stories in 1940 in Berlin. There were people writing poems in the trenches of World War One. There were people writing epic poetry as Rome fell. Art doesn't stop for history. Art is history. Because when you look back at Rome, when you look back at the First World War, what we have is what people wrote down. We have the poems, we have the diaries, we have the art. So we have to keep going, we have to keep writing, we have to keep imagining. And if, as Pete says, anti-intellectualism is rising, then every story we write, every book we publish is an act of resistance, it's an act of rebellion, it's an act of bringing forth into the world something that didn't exist before, something beautiful, something artistic, something that says to whoever might pick it up and read it, even if they're only reading it while they're waiting to use it to start a fire after the apocalypse or something. But it says, we were here, we were alive, we wrote this, we thought this, we had these thoughts, we had these dreams, we put all this down on paper to tell you that we critique our present. We understand our present, we critique it, even if we critique it by writing escapism, even if we critique it by writing flowery love poetry, we're still bringing into the world something that certain people in the world don't want brought into the world. So just by writing, just by imagining, just by drawing, we are striking a blow against the forces of entropy.
If I could just come in briefly on that, about 5 years ago I did an interview with Nick Hardaway, who is a great science fiction writer, and we were talking about the way in which the world had changed, the things that made it difficult, and his contention was that most books, most realist novels that needed to be written at the moment would have looked like science fiction 10 years ago, because the way in which our world has changed with mobile phones and the internet and so on is completely science fictional compared to what it was when those things didn't exist. We have technology now which looks incredibly futuristic compared to the science fiction stuff that was on television when I was a kid. And most realist writers haven't caught up with that. They're still writing books set in sort of Agatha Christie days. And you can't write a crime novel in a world that doesn't have mobile phones anymore. So from that point of view, the whole realist fiction thing collapsed long before we did. It's not science, really, that's the issue these days. It's that the world has gone completely batshit crazy. And that's something that could have happened without all of the science. So I don't think that's a problem, but I think you're absolutely right. We do need to keep on writing. And I was just trying to find something I retweeted yesterday, that somebody had pulled out a quote from The Lord of the Rings, when Sam and Frodo are having their darkest hour somewhere in the midst of Mordor. And Sam has this magnificent, actually I think it's at the end of book two, Sam has this magnificent monologue about how we have to carry on because that's all that's left for us to do. I think that's absolutely right. Tolkien, of course, lived through World War One, so that's where he got that from. Are there any other questions from the audience?
I just have one. I'd just like to, sort of, for all of our authors, you know, sort of, we'd love to end up having you here.
but I wonder, who do you like to read? Who's inspiring you at the moment? Who's just a joy to read? Who do you feel, who do you want to champion? Who's a writer that we should all be reading?
So last year, Joe Hall had this Discovery Challenge, which I completely failed at, which was to read a woman new to you on a monthly basis and review. So obviously the way that would work best is if they're still alive and still writing, so that your review actually means something and bring people to them. And I completely failed to do it last year for a variety of reasons, so I'm trying to do it again this year. So far this year, I've read two very fabulous books as part of this challenge. So the first is by Sarah Bowne, I don't know if that's how you exactly pronounce the name, and this is a literary book, so wouldn't fit in with the science fiction part that well, but it's called Spills in the Falter Wither, and she's an Irish writer, and it's just a beautiful book. It's really well worth reading as a writer, just for the craft of it. It's very poetic, it's beautiful, and you end up with something in your eye at the end. On the science fiction side, I've just read Elia Whiteley's Arrival of Missives, which is brilliant, and it's up for a BSFA award, and it'll probably be up for more awards. And it's a very short novel, I think it's about 120 pages long. And again, it's very beautifully rewritten, but the ideas are very striking, very original as well. And it's a science fiction novel set around about the time of the First World War.
I've just read Emma Newman's two new sci-fi books, After Atlas and Planetfall. Totally blown away by them. She's taken her, I mean, her other books are very good, but she's taken us into a whole new level with those two. Planetfall especially reads like a classic sci-fi novel, and you can't believe it's only 2 years old. It reads like, you know, a pillar of the genre already, which is Planetfall by Emma Newman. Aside from that, I've just read Sarah Pinborough's new one, Behind Her Eyes. Cracking book. She doesn't need a plug from me. She's a number one in the Sunday Times bestseller list, for God's sake. I need a plug from her. What else have I read recently? Anne Leckie's trilogy, The Ancillary Justice, Ancillary Mercy and Ancillary Sword. Again, cracking, absolutely cracking sci-fi. For people who are jonesing for Ian M. Banks, I'd suggest giving that one a go. Apart from that, nothing springs to mind at the moment.
What was that, Ian Banks?
The Ancillary Justice.
What's it about?
By Anne Leckie. It's about a... Well,
you can do this. I'll try to explain it to people and just like read it.
Yeah. It's about a spaceship who used to use the animated corpses of prisoners of war as drones, basically. And when it's destroyed in an act of treachery, it leaves behind only one drone, which is the animated corpse of one of its former prisoners. And it's a warship encased in the body of a person. The other thing about this novel is you're never entirely sure which sex any of the characters are. But it's this one person who is seeking revenge on this kind of emperor of the society in which it lives.
Galaxy.
Yeah, but it's been reduced to just one human body instead of one massive starship. So it's over the course of three novels, it's quite a belter, actually.
So now I've kind of stolen my thunder in recommending Emma Newman. I too think The Planetfall and After Atlas are a complete step up. I mean, the fairy books were great, but Planetfall and After Atlas, really, really quality. Planetfall was on my Hugo list last year, and After Atlas will be on this year's. And if you're looking for a book which talks about the way the world is now, After Atlas is that book. It is absolutely brilliantly prescient from that point of view. The book that I've just finished reading is The Stars Are Legion by Cameron Hurley, just come out. It's space opera, and it's a space opera in which every single character is female. And the Legion, by the way, is a fleet of planet-sized ships. So there are a lot of women in this book, and no men whatsoever. And it's all based on biotech, and reproduction is key to the way in which the entire world works. So it's very interesting from that point of view. It's also much tighter than Cameron's previous two novels as well. So either she's got better on that, or it's a good editor. Prior to that, I read Lunar Wolf Moon, which is only available as an ARC at the moment, but it will be out in a month or two. That's the sequel to New Moon. So this is a science fiction series for which the elevator pitch is Dallas on the Moon. So the moon has been settled by a bunch of capitalist families, each one of which is invested in a different industry, and they have rivalries and they murder each other and whatever, and they have lots of sex. So that's quite fascinating. And Ian McDonald, of course, is one of those people. He's been writing for a very long time now, and he's very, very good. So those would be definite recommendations from my part. Anybody else got any other questions? Okay, I have a question for one of the audience. Justin, you've got a book out the back. Tell us about it.
Okay. Yeah, just launched on Saturday. The Genes Oasis. It's ancient Egyptian rock. I'm not sure it's got any of the attributes that you guys have been talking about, but it's the first debut novel from me. And it's, I set out to try to write a speculative account of the origins of our race today. So it's got angels and men and hybrids, all sorts of mixed creatures and mixed genetics, and it culminates in the flood. There's copies of that at the back, and it's also available now on Amazon and bookstores.
Cool.
I've just reviewed it on my website.
Peter's just reviewed it on his website. I've got a couple of things I want to mention as well. First of all, the Nebula shortlists have come out just today. So if you haven't been checking Twitter, it's all over there. Lots of really good novels and short stories and whatever being nominated. I'm pleased to note that our local hero, Philip Reeve, has Railhead, his young adult novel about, it's essentially an intergalactic civilization connected by giant trains, which travel through wormholes and whatever from planetary system to planetary system. That's on the Andrew Norton Award shortlist. So well done, Philip. Keep up the pride of the Southwest then. I was going to ask Tom, wasn't I? I was going to ask Tom, what's happening with Fringe?
Oh, what is happening with Fringe? People are craning their necks because I'm beautiful and they want to look at me. We've got a lot. So we're going to get the full announcements out later this week, but we're booked up till May, so we've got some really great guests coming. Next month, we have a returning guest of Paul Cornell, Doctor Who writing and some such, with his novel Chalk, which is a standalone novel, set in the 1980s in a school, and spooky urban fantasy, dark fantasy goings on. So that should be very good. And he'll be supported by local writer Stephanie Minns, who has written a lot of gothic horror and is a stalwart performer at Talking Tales, if any of you have seen her there. So it'll be her first Fringe. So if you haven't seen it, she'll be promoting her new book of short stories called The Obsidian Path, which is very good. I recommend you all seek out on Amazon, and if you're not sure, then you'll hear a story next time and you'll definitely seek it out on Amazon. So that's what we've got with Fringe. There are some other storytelling nights that we just just want to make you aware of, if you like this sort of thing, next week on Thursday, 2nd of March, in Stokes Croft, there is Let Me Tell You a Story, Jack, which is a 5-minute sort of fiction, anecdote, stand-up, poems, theatres, spoken word event, free to go, performers get a free pint, so it gets more interesting in the second half. But it's great fun, so that's a good one to go to. And next month, when we've got ours on the 20th, on a Monday, on the 19th, the day before, at the Wardrobe Theatre in Old Market Assembly, there's Story Slam, which is an incredible event, which is now turning away more people that can actually attend. I think they turned away 200 people last time. They allowed, well, the health and safety say 101, but they managed to fit in 148. It's another incredible spoken word event. All true stories, all on a theme. The next theme is Dusk Till Dawn. Some very funny, very insightful stories. It's a great afternoon. It's 2:30 in the afternoon. It's a pay what you want, but typically £4. But it's a great, great event. Other things coming out later in the year, but we'll save those for future events. Exciting things happening in Bristol, we will keep you posted as much as we can. Thank you.
Has anybody else got any events that they want to plug on this?
I want to say Pub Night is going ahead as always next Monday. It's in the old venue because people like the beer there. Crazy bastards. The Shakespeare Tavern, 27th, usual time, usual meet.
I have a couple of things coming up on Saturday. During the afternoon, between about 1 and 4, there is an LGBT History Month event at the Watershed, put on by Bristol Pride. In theory, it's sold out, but it's one of these things where they put free tickets up on Eventbrite, so there's no guarantee that all the people who actually said they will come. So there's a possibility that you will be able to get in. The headline act is a lady from the Tate in London, who's going to be doing a preview of a fabulous new exhibition they've got coming out soon of art by LGBT people. And I'm going to be doing transgender history through art down the ages, covering 4,500 years of history in 20 minutes. I'm trying to talk very quickly. And then on Saturday night, at the Unitarian Chapel in Brussels Square, the Women's Equality Party is having a mic event called What Women Want. So if you are a woman or at least a feminist and you want to go along and have a 5-minute rant about what you want to see in the world, then please do come along and say a little bit. I have been asked to speak, so I should be there, and I need to write something to say. I better get on with that at some point. Anybody else got anything? Jonathan?
Is this thing actually working?
Yes. Yeah.
Right. No, just an announcement. It went up on Twitter today. I've got a sort of three-story chapbook thing coming out this summer. A few years ago, I had a shot at writing high fantasy, the Kith the Taker stories. And two of those were published in Blackgate. Writing a third brand spanking new one, be coming out this book, which is coming out this summer, published by AAM. So there you go.
Thank you. Yes, talking of high fantasy reminds me, Chad Williams is returning to the world of Austin Arn from his first series, Memories Are All in Form. So he has a novella out called The Heart of What Was Lost, which tells the tale of the end of the Storm War, the Storm King War, where the Dark Elf characters are retreating into their mountain fasthold, pursued by a large army of men desperately trying to save the last remnants of their race. And it's absolutely brilliant. And then there's going to be a trilogy coming out starting later this year. So if you are into epic fantasy, it doesn't come much better than Chad Williams. Anybody else got stuff? In which case? bits, I think we're done. Thank you ever so much. Do please tell everybody. March the 20th.
March 20th.
Paul Cornell, bring all of your friends. We've got plenty of room for them. Yeah. We've got great beer, and we look forward to seeing you then.
Yes. And thank you to Gareth and Pete for your lovely business.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
The Bristol Con Fringe is a monthly podcast produced by the Bristol Con Foundation. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174. We'd like to thank the famous Royal Navy volunteer for providing us with a venue, and we'd like to thank you for listening. If you would like to keep up to date with our events, please like our Bristol Con Fringe page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at BrizConFringe.